Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Synchronic, which is the latest Benson and Moorhead film, although apparently there's some confusion as to what order these co-directors are putting their names these days. Benson and Moorhead has been the standard up to this point, and it makes sense because it's alphabetical, but in the opening credits of Synchronic, they are referred to as Moorhead and Benson.
Well, you see, Jim, they've ascended and no longer view the alphabet linearly. They've taken a drug which enables them to see the alphabet the way it truly is. It's like grooves on a record. We will expound upon this later. Have no fear of that. But yeah, no, I mean, but then in the end credits, I believe that we're back to Benson and Moorhead. I agree with you, though. Benson and Moorhead, it's like a law firm. You know, you just get used to seeing the names in a particular order. Moorhead and Benson has the same ring as like Ethan and Joel Cohen. It's just, and that is alphabetical, but sounds wrong just because it's not what we're accustomed to.
Right. Yeah, I never thought about that.
Well, maybe it's because Joel Cohen was given sole director credit for so long, so he's always kind of had primacy in the public imagination. But I think mostly people just call them the Cohen brothers, but if you say their names, it's always J-E for whatever reason.
Is Joel the older brother?
Are they twins? Are they not
twins?
No, they're not. Yeah, you're right. They're not twins. I knew that. Who am I thinking of? Who's twins? Are the Hughes brothers twins?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, in any case, it's not especially relevant. So, Benson and Moorhead, their previous features have been Resolution, Spring.
The Endless.
And The Endless. Resolution and The Endless, spoilers for those movies.
We watched Spring first. That's probably what's fucking me up.
It could be.
Again, I've become unstuck in time here, apparently.
Spoilers for Resolution and The Endless. They are part of a stealth Benson and Moorhead cinematic universe.
Yes, that was quite a delight to discover that. One is a stealth sequel to the other.
Yes, and thanks to some wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey fuckery, which sort of forms the core of, well, to a certain extent, Resolution, but particularly The Endless. And then, if it's even possible, that is even more true of Synchronic. Synchronic is really just a straight-up time travel movie. That's what it's about.
Yeah, yeah. It's very... Resolution is fucking inscrutable. It's this total enigma. And then The Endless is like a Rosetta Stone for understanding Resolution in a kind of odd way. I'm hard-pressed to think of a time when another sequel, stealth or otherwise, has come along to give, like, a YouTube ending explained, you know, kind of explanation for what the fuck the first movie was about. All the more delightful because it's a Trojan horse where you wouldn't even see that coming. The Endless
did not
bill itself as a sequel to Resolution, hence my use of the word stealth. I was actually kind of low-key dreading the moment in today's movie, Synchronic, where Anthony Mackie found himself in one or more Benson Moorhead joints from years past, because he does spend a lot of this movie unstuck in time, Billy Pilgriming around. And it would have been very easy for them to just collapse their whole filmography into one sort of pudding.
They do not do that.
Yeah, so they exercise admirable self-restraint.
So that's a plus for them. But the film follows two paramedics in New Orleans, played by Anthony Mackie and Jamie Dornan, who are encountering, in the course of their emergency calls, this new designer drug called Synchronic, fittingly enough.
It's linked to a lot of very peculiar rationality-defying deaths, not just overdoses.
Yeah,
but
deaths and injuries, and it's not, well, I am confused simply because I never thought of quote-unquote designer drugs being sold in, like, gas stations and, like, tobacco shops. I always think of designer drugs being, like, fancy and expensive and, you know,
still illegal.
Nightclubs and, yeah, still illegal. As opposed to something like, I don't know, K2 from 6 or 8 years ago.
Right. Yeah, I always took designer drug to mean you will be in trouble if you're caught with it, but if you can afford it, you probably won't be in that much trouble because you can afford to get out of the trouble that you're in.
Right.
Whereas if you're caught with a crack pipe, you'll be in much more dire straits.
Unless you're Jordan Belfort.
Right.
Smoke crack with me, Jordan! Oh, that That's a delight of a film. Anyway, Matt, how about you kick off a synopsis for us?
By all means. So you open with two people tripping balls separately. One gentleman disembarks an elevator and finds himself in a sandstorm in a desert, just sand stretching all the way to the horizon. The other woman is tripping her ass off in her bedroom and sees vines and other botanical growths encroaching. A figure, a bearded, masked man, emerges from the wall. A snake starts slithering between her legs. She's having herself a total freak out. And then we get our title drop. We're introduced to our two main characters, paramedics. Not initially clear which one of them is going to shoulder the protagonist burden. Come to find out sooner or later, it's Anthony Mackie. Jamie Dornan, is that his name? The other guy? So Anthony Mackie and Jamie Dornan show up to a trap house, looks like, you know, a flop, and there's an overdose and then a guy who's been run through with a sword. Which they have to do some CSI Sherlock deduction to figure that out. Initially, it's just a stab wound to the chest, and then they roll him over and find out that the stab wound also has an exit wound. He's been run through with a 3-foot knife, is what they originally call it. And then one of the cops who gives them a hard time throughout the movie. All of the cops in this movie are just boorish assholes, which is kind of funny. He says, I'm pretty sure they call it something else. And then they find a sword embedded in the wall.
Yeah.
An old-timey sword, an antique-looking sword, crucially. A cutlass, I guess you would call it.
Possibly.
Well, it's curved. It's got like a kind of ornate hilt. I don't know. I'm not an expert. It looks like something out of fucking Pirates of the Caribbean.
In any case, the guy who's been run through looks an awful lot like the guy who was in the elevator in the opening. It's not that guy.
No, he meets a different, equally sticky end.
Stickier, even. Stickier, I would say. Because he's alive when they find the guy with the hole in him. It's never really disclosed whether he makes it or not. I believe he's alive when they get him in the ambulance. But
there's a message scrawled on the wall, too. It's not clear what the substance is. It says time is a lie.
Yeah.
In the room with the ODing chick.
Yes. The next few scenes are a mixture of getting to know the two leads and then following them around on some more of these calls.
Seems like every call they get has to do with a drug overdose of some kind, and more often than not, Synchronic is mixed up in it somehow.
Yeah. Jamie Dornan is married. He's got an 18-year-old daughter, and then he's got a newborn, and he's telling his buddy about how, you know, don't do it that way. It's a nightmare. If you're going to have kids, and if you're going to have multiple kids, have them closer together.
Uh-huh.
You might be thinking, oh, hey, free babysitter, but Brianna, that's his daughter's name, Brianna's a lousy babysitter. It's not a benefit.
Love her to death, but...
Right. Meanwhile, Anthony Mackie is a ladies' man and a bit of a party animal. He drinks too much, kind of does recreational drugs, hungover a lot, and his buddy's starting to get worried about him.
He has an amusing monologue where he talks to the older of his partner's children, the 18-year-old, and she's a little world weary herself, at least for her age. She is not impressed with the beer that he's drinking. I think, does he offer it to her? I don't remember. He's like giving her a hard time, and she dismisses it as cheap beer. So she's kind of old for her years too, and he has an amusing monologue where he talks about how he set up her parents because he met her mother at a bar, and at the time his love life was too much of a juggling act and there was no room for new applicants. So
thin the herd was his turn of phrase.
So he pawned her off on his buddy who was going through a drought.
Yeah.
He's just, you know. And
bing, bang, boom.
That's why you exist.
Nearly two decades of marriage.
Uh-huh.
So it's around this time when, again, these two guys go out on another call and they go out to the motel, hotel, whatever, where the opening took place. They find the woman back there with a snake bite, and they have this fucking like know-it-all CSI tech who's like
a real Dr. House type.
You know, it's not poison, it's venom, and those bites can't be from a cotton mouth or whatever the fuck. They have to be from this other thing, and those haven't been around for decades in this area.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. Basically informing our protagonists, because we already know, that this snake bite is whack as fuck.
My favorite corpse that they come upon in the line of duty is the charred remains of a man in the middle of a disused fairground. It's a great backdrop to find what the cops dismiss as a case of spontaneous combustion, rather amusingly, because they couldn't care less how he came to be there in that condition.
Right.
But the rattlesnake lady was also pretty intriguing.
Yeah. And then they go to the elevator shaft at the hotel, and this is where they find the man, and this is when I discovered that he was not, in fact, pierced through the chest in the trap house. They find him at the bottom of the elevator shaft in pieces with a blissed out smile on his face. So he met a sticky end,
yes.
Clearly.
Stickier, for those of you keeping track at home. Stickiest, I would say, of all of our hapless victims. In the midst of all this, Anthony Mackie is getting a series of MRIs and is told that he has a brain tumor, a tumor on his pineal gland. I always thought it was pineal. In the movie, they mostly say pineal, I think. Doesn't really matter. I just don't want to sound like a horse's ass.
Well, I don't think we have any neurologists among our listening base, neurosurgeons or anything. but I agree with you. I've always heard pineal, not pineal.
Well, it's unanimous then.
In any case, yeah, he has a tumor. And there's something about how, besides the tumor, he's got this very active gland that resembles more a teenager's pineal gland than a middle-aged man, because typically by then it's sort of calcified. And
right.
So this becomes
It's fitting because
later.
He's a little bit of a man-child.
Also that. But it becomes plot relevant further on.
Yes.
So Brianna, who's a bit of a party animal, in addition to being a world-weary 18-year-old, goes missing.
Yeah, she was dabbling in harder stuff than she had, as you know, tired of wetting her whistle with cheap beer or beer of any kind, apparently.
With a Natty Light or Beer 30. the single funniest name for a beer I've ever encountered. Comes in a 30 rack, if you couldn't figure that out. It's
you
actually
would have to have had a lot of beer 30s to not be able to figure that out. A half rack, at least,
I would say. Hey. So they actually, Anthony Mackie and Jamie Dornan, figure out that Brianna has gone missing while they're out on a call. They go out on a call. One kid's OD'd. Apparently he's got a heart problem and he took too much cocaine. Why are you taking any cocaine when you have heart issues? That's fucking stupid.
Here for a good time, not a long time.
It's guaranteed to make your fucking heart explode. And there's a girl who's there and she's still alive, but high as balls. She says something about like, yeah, I don't know where Brianna went. And this hits them like a bolt from the blue because they don't know this girl. It's not like, oh, I recognize one of my daughter's friends. This
right.
is just completely news to them. And yeah, she's just wandered off.
She was sitting right over there in that chair. A lot of emphasis. Camera cuts to this empty lawn chair.
Yeah. And she's just missing. They go through all kinds of efforts to track her down. Jamie Dornan thinks he's doing all he could do. His wife seems to think otherwise. Their marriage hits the skids pretty decisively and pretty abruptly. And there's just a lot of it cuts back and forth between the two of them, Jamie Dornan and Anthony Mackie. And whenever it cuts to Jamie Dornan, it's always the same construct where he like goes to the bedroom door to knock on it, and then it goes to a flashback of happier times.
Right.
They do that like 3 or 4 times. But meanwhile, Anthony Mackie is on this mission to track down this drug.
And clean up the streets.
Clean up the streets. You know, he goes in to this smoke shop and demands, okay, I want all of that you've got back there.
He tries to clean out their whole inventory.
Do you have
synchronic
any more in the back?
And apparently it's been criminalized now, like it's dried up. So she says this is the last of it, not just for like this week, but in perpetuity.
Yeah.
So there's a shady character standing behind Anthony Mackie while he's doing all of this. He buys a whole shelf of Synchronic for a little over $100.
And then proceeds to castigate the woman at the counter, who is very taken aback.
he goes back out onto the street. The guy is pursuing him and offers to buy it off him. He says, I'll give you three times what you just paid for it.
Which he quickly ups to like $2,000.
I'll give you $2,000. He does everything short of begging to suck his dick. So he looks like a fiend. And then Anthony Mackie gets in his car and takes off.
Go home to your wife, yeah.
Yeah.
Shortly thereafter, Anthony Mackie is at home alone. And he hears a strange noise coming from another room. And he's looking around. And eventually, he finds this fiend in his closet. And it turns out he's not a fiend. He's a doctor. And he's the doctor who synthesized this drug.
Yeah, he was a chemist. And he made a bunch of street legal drug adjacent substances that were molecularly distinct enough from the drugs they were modeled on to skirt around regulations, but eventually the FDA or whoever cracked down on his operation, so he had to just rush to market whatever he had left over, and it was a synthetic, I think DMT is synthetic, but an off-brand DMT, if you will, a designer drug DMT that he discovers has latent time travel properties.
Yeah, I'm a little fuzzy on exactly how he described it. One, because I think it's left somewhat intentionally fuzzy. And two, because it's me, for once, who was having a little bit of trouble staying awake.
Yes, my redemption arc at long last. After a 5-episode streak of me catching Z's or staving off the Sandman, my co-host is finally dropping the ball ever so slightly. But I couldn't be happier about that, just to be clear.
Yeah,
my time to shine.
I woke up very early this morning after not that much sleep, so I was having a bit of trouble. But nevertheless, the basic idea is that for adults, for people with calcified pineal glands, it produces hallucinations, and you see stuff from different times, and sometimes maybe something pops out at you or whatever, but if you're a teenager or if you have an abnormal gland, like, hint, hint, Anthony Mackie, you actually travel back in time. And so he was trying to get all this shit off the streets. You know, he's buying out everybody's supplies.
He was doing what Anthony Mackie was doing, but on a national scale, going city to city, store to store.
Trying to clean up his own mistake.
This is where the record analogy comes into play. He says that you set the needle down in a particular groove and you hear a particular moment of a particular song, but the songs are all there and the drug helps you hop between them. The drug is the needle, I think, is what he says.
The drug is the needle.
Yeah, that was a little loaded.
A little bit. So Anthony Mackie concludes that Brianna has become unstuck in time. Or more appropriately, unstuck and then stuck elsewhere. Elsewhen.
Right.
So he has to take it upon himself to try and track her down. And shortly thereafter, he discovers that he is going to have a limited number of attempts because he has a limited supply of Synchronic because he hears some news report where the scientist... Did he kill himself or was he murdered?
The radio lady says something about cyanide capsules, so I take that to be suicide.
Yeah.
But
so,
way to go. It's better than falling down an elevator shaft.
Right, although that guy appeared to be pretty happy about it.
That's true.
So this gives the trips an urgency factor. Otherwise, if that guy was alive, and presumably if Anthony Mackie went to him and said, hey, I need the drug for this very specific purpose, the dude would just keep giving him as much as he needed until he got the job done.
Yeah, well, it's time travel movies are always so hard-pressed to generate any stakes at all. They always have to contrive some reason why you have a finite number of trips or just to give some permanence to the action. Because time travel just lends itself to limitless retries and
right.
Therefore no real urgency.
So this is the way they cap that, by
right.
Killing the maker of the drug.
Plus, he starts conducting a series of experiments, and he discovers that where you are geographically when you take the pill or when it kicks in, rather, which does not take long to occur, that determines where you are sent. Even just in his own room, like within 10 feet of his couch, he can go to different centuries.
At opposite ends of his couch.
Right.
He goes to different places.
Yeah, separate couch cushions.
Right.
And that, too, gives the trips more stakes, because it's not a situation where, even if he overshot, well, then again, he has a brain tumor. His time on this earth is finite. So this might not be the case for him, but for your average time traveler, if you overshoot your target by 10 years, you can just wait a decade and then do what you came there to do, you know, but you can't wait 1,000 years or 100 years or
right.
However long. He has a brush with a caveman. He has a brush with a conquistador. He goes all over the damn place.
Yeah. Eventually, he also runs a test with his dog.
This was a real heartbreaker.
Yeah. To see if you're like holding on to something or someone, will it go back with you? And it does.
Because he has already deduced that people can bring not inorganic objects back with them. The dead guy in the fairground had a doorknob in his hand, antique doorknob, obviously the sword from the aforementioned stabbing scene.
Right. So he successfully takes his dog back, but then he gets in an altercation with a racist, essentially. I mean, it's like sometime in United States slave era, antebellum Louisiana, New Orleans specifically.
I thought I saw a Model T parked in the background, but it's
well, it is at minimum Jim Crow.
Yeah, right. It's bad news no matter what.
So he's a black man who finds himself standing uninvited in a white man's living room or whatever, with exactly the results you would expect.
Uh-huh. And this time, for whatever reason, every other jaunt that he's been on, he's come back 7 minutes later. This time, for whatever reason, that is not the case. He has to pop a second pill in order to come back, and that takes some doing. He needs to be in exactly the right spot, or God knows where he'll wind up. So he has to go back into the guy's living room, where he's not wanted, to say the least, and gets into an altercation with the guy. His dog slips out of his hands. He's fumbling for the leash, but he's already dematerializing. Every time he's going between time periods, his skin starts like Swiss cheesing.
Mm-hmm.
He disappears a little bit at a time. And so his hand is like phasing through the leash. Very frustrating to watch. And he wakes up back in his room, back on his couch, holding the leash.
But not the dog.
And we don't know this right away because we just see the leash sort of looped over the back of the couch, we think, for a second. We hear the dog actually whimper. He looks outside, sees a mournful dog phantom.
Yes.
Out on the lawn, which then dematerializes. Very sad. The dog always is wearing a mournful expression.
It's just a very sad-looking dog.
They probably cast it on that basis.
Probably. That would not be surprising. Find me the saddest dog in the state of Louisiana. So he's been recording on video, a little camcorder on a tripod, his various experiments. And so he meets up with his buddy, and his buddy's talking about how his marriage is falling apart, and it's because I'm such a fucking asshole, and I don't deserve her, etc. And I don't know exactly how they segue conversationally into this, but Anthony Mackie, in addition to telling his friend, oh yeah, by the way, I have cancer, because he hasn't told him yet, also shows him the video on the camcorder, which has the dude shook, and he of course realizes the implication immediately. We can go and get her, but there's this finite number of pills. Jamie Dornan wants to go back for his own daughter. Anthony Mackie explains the whole pineal gland thing and why he can't, because he's got a normal one for a 40-something-year-old man, and Anthony Mackie doesn't.
Which is a neat explanation. Normally a scene like that would play out with one of them being the hero. You know, it's like that scene that I didn't like on first blush and has not grown on me since in Endgame, where Black Widow and Hawkeye are debating which one is going to valiantly sacrifice themselves. I'm sick to death of scenes like that. Here, we skirt that issue completely because only one of them is physically capable
right.
of time travel.
Yeah.
So it just nips it right in the bud, which was refreshing.
Yeah. So they make an attempt Wait, does Anthony Mackie make the attempt from the lawn chair by himself beforehand? Or
I think that precedes the bar scene. Yeah, he originally tries it from the lawn chair, operating on the assumption that that's where the daughter disappeared, and he wakes up near a bonfire with a circle of shamans around it. And then they chase him into the woods.
And he nearly gets subdued and possibly sacrificed. And then winks back into the present day. The remaining drug addict is still there.
What are you doing on my roof?
Like, was this the last place she was when you last saw her? I don't know. She, like, wandered off or something. Why didn't you tell me that?
Yeah, Anthony Mackie is pretty funny throughout all of his YouTube time travel vlogging. That tantrum is maybe the comedic highlight of the movie.
Yeah. But anyway, once the two of them, Jamie Dornan and Anthony Mackie, are teamed up in the time travel endeavor, they realize there's this rock out by a shoreline. This is where Anthony Mackie and Brianna have their cheap beer conversation.
Right.
And it's got a message scrawled on it, just the word always, which never really gets entirely explained by the end of the movie, but it's not a big point, so I'm not that worried about it.
I sort of like, well, I'll talk about this more either just after the break or just before, but carry on.
So the two of them are just kind of talking about life and just waiting for the whole thing to kick off. Anthony Mackie is perched on the rock. Jamie Dornan is sort of sitting beside it. And, you know, like mid-conversation while Jamie Dornan's talking, he just hears a beer bottle hit the ground and break, and his buddy's gone.
Yeah, it's funny. That scene was getting way too philosophical for my liking, and then it's just brought to a screeching halt with the smash of that. It's like the filmmakers realize they're getting too big for their britches, and so they just kind of clamp down on it.
Have to lampshade it.
The two of them are talking about life and death and time and destiny and so on, and a lot of it is kind of interesting and diverting, but it gets a little long in the tooth. And then smash, all of a sudden it's a monologue. And it's funny too, because anyone who's even dabbled in drugs casually, maybe especially if you've only gotten high a handful of times, you know that, like, you're sober until you're not. So him just winking out of existence is kind of a relatable experience. You know, it's like he has a funny moment, Anthony Mackie, the first time he takes Synchronic when he's on the couch. There's a cut from him having popped it to him just kind of sitting around looking unimpressed. And it's a classic, like, man, these edibles ain't shit kind of moment. And then all of a sudden, oh no, I'm being menaced by a conquistador and there's an alligator behind me. I'm stuck between a rock and a gator place.
Yeah.
It's a bad trip.
There's some earlier cuts that are kind of like that, and I'll talk more about those after the break, but it's kind of a recurring theme in a sense, a motif more than a theme. But that particular one, yeah, is really more of a straight-up comedy beat.
Right.
And it is a good one, you're right. So Anthony Mackie winks into a battlefield, basically. I don't know if it's supposed to be Civil War or what war it's supposed to be.
I didn't know what conflict it was supposed to be. I thought it was a post-apocalyptic future until I saw the burning ship in the harbor.
Right. It's probably
a sailboat, you know, like a Nina Pinta Santa Maria kind of situation.
Yeah. It's probably a Civil War thing, but there's no guarantee of that, and it doesn't really matter. He is looking around for her. He crawls through a trench for a while. Eventually, I think he hears her whistling, was it? Anyway, he finds her.
No, the whistling is that comes along shortly thereafter, I think. He finds her in a trench atop a little mound of corpses, and they reunite, and he gives her a pill. Once again, the movie subverts the expectation, like the debate, who's going to take the pill, who's going to be the hero, who's going to stay behind. She just pops it, no questions asked, and then says, "Where's yours?" You know, so it's not that it doesn't occur to her, but there's still a self-preservation instinct there to kind of head that cliche off at the pass.
Right.
By the time she thinks to ask, the decision's been made.
Yeah. So he explains all the particulars of how the process works, and they have to kind of book it back to the rock. They get intercepted by this scruffy looking dude,
and I believe he's whistling when he emerges from the the 1917 haze of of battle. You know, the burnt, everything is on fire. It's got a very Roger Deakins, like, orange skyline kind of a look to it. Mm-hmm. It's like a shoestring 1917,
basically treating Anthony Mackie like a runaway slave.
Yes.
And so he leaves Brianna sitting perched on the rock and, you know, he's taking steps toward the other guy. The guy looks to be on the verge of stepping on a landmine.
Or like an unexploded shell or something. I wasn't clear what that was.
He misses it a few different times. Meanwhile, the present is winking in and out, by which I mean relative to where they are at that point, the future, which is a signal that the pill's about to kick in. And when push comes to shove, Brianna sort of winks back to the present day, and Anthony Mackie is left behind. Shortly thereafter, the dude manages to step on whatever the exploding thing was and blow himself up.
Mm-hmm.
Brianna and her father have a happy reunion, and then they spot Anthony Mackie a la his dog from earlier on.
Doing the ghost dog routine.
And there's a juddery, shaky handshake between him and Jamie Dornan.
And we linger on the handshake for a good long while before the credits roll, and I thought that the movie was trying to imply more that ambiguity that I
maybe come back.
It looks like that maybe he's solidifying, and I didn't really like that, but then I remembered, aha, nobody carved that message into the rock. So it took an ambiguous final shot, and actually that made it much more conclusive. Like, he has to go back, because otherwise who wrote the damn thing? But yeah. I like that the movie doesn't show him carving always into the rock, both because it would be a little bit sappy and also because it's a little bit of a brain tickler once the credits start rolling. If you're asking yourself, aha, did he, didn't he? I mean, did he or didn't he come back? You haven't been paying attention, I think. I mean, that was my read anyway.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, first of all, I agree that it seems...
Maybe it wasn't even meant to be ambiguous, but it seems like they linger on that handshake for... I mean, he lingers longer than his dog does, for sure. Right.
I think it was relatively clear-cut that he was not going to be sticking around, but they do set up that he must have been the one who put Always on the rock, because he says something to Brianna when he finds her in the trench.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
About, like, well, you know, we saw your message. Like, what message? So, she didn't put it there.
Right.
Anyway, that's Synchronic, so we'll go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with more afterwards.
If you're watching this, I'm probably trying to convince you of something pretty unbelievable, or I'm dead.
I'd do anything to get her back, but this is...
I mean, the next dose could kill you.
There are things that are far worse than death.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
What happened to them?
They're not returning.
It's gotta be me.
You can't deal with reality.
Yeah, because you're a...
The clock keeps ticking down.
The time is an illusion.
And we're back. So, Matt, how about you take us away here?
It's not a true blue horror movie by any means. I mean, the string of ODs at the beginning have a sort of Seven-esque, like David Fincher's Seven, structure to them. Each new crime scene is kind of more outlandish than the one preceding it. And that I liked. That felt to me like shades of a 90s serial killer flick. And you know I eat that shit up.
We both do.
Yeah. You know, being a child of the 90s with kind of morbid preoccupations, I think anyone with a modicum of taste has to have some appreciation for that weird little subgenre. They're just too delicious. But then once the time travel begins in earnest, once it basically becomes the Anthony Mackie show with him monologuing to his camcorder and apparating in and out of the Jim Crow South and God knows where else, it becomes much more overtly comedic and more sci-fi to the exclusion of anything else.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no horror elements to speak of at all after that point. So it's sort of two beasts, the movie. And I have to say, not just because we're the Shock Doctors.
Inside this movie, there are two bears.
Not just because we're the Shock Doctors, but also because I have those aforementioned morbid inclinations, I have to say I sort of preferred the opening act, or at least the horror ambiance hanging over the opening act. And I wish that it had preserved that spirit a little bit more. I have to say, especially everything leading up to the title drop sets you up for a horror head trip of a movie, you know, just a real bad trip, a hallucinogenic trip to hell. And the movie doesn't really deliver on that promise, I don't think. It reminded me of another movie I was a little bit lukewarm on, which we watched not long ago, not for the podcast, In the Shadow of the Moon.
Okay.
So many time travel movies become, I don't know quite how to put this, maudlin is too strong a word, but time travel dramas are often
too self-serious.
A little too self-serious and kind of narratively neat and tidy.
Yeah.
So it always turns into this sort of Ouroboros where everything that happens was meant to happen. They're always striving for this significance that I often don't really feel in my bones. And this movie is no exception. Although I did like this movie. I think I liked it more than In the Shadow of the Moon. It, on balance, it is, I don't know if it's my favorite Benson-Moorhead-Benson joint, but it's up there.
Yeah, I would say, first of all, I agree with you in terms of sort of genre-wise where it is and where I might have preferred to have it go. The Endless, in its wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff, it's much more still a horror movie because it's like a cosmic sort of, the world is unraveling in this particular physical space.
Right. It's a little more Lovecraftian, less like Philip K. Dick.
Right.
It's also about a cult.
It's about a suicide cult.
Yeah, that's the backdrop for the whole thing. So it's got inescapable horror trappings for that reason.
Yeah, it's got the Jonestown thing going for it along with it. So we both liked The Endless in, I think, episode 8.5 did our end of 2018 retrospective, which we've brought up again in subsequent episodes before this one. But we mentioned it in that, and it's, you know, it's good stuff. I would say that's probably my favorite Benson-Moorhead film.
I think its total incomprehensibility, notwithstanding, Resolution might be my favorite.
Okay.
Just because I liked the chemistry. I mean, Benson-Moorhead movies are so often about male camaraderie, and I think that one had my favorite interplay between the two male leads, one of whom is trying to get the other to kick a drug habit. He's got him chained to a radiator. It's a classic detox, tough love situation.
Yeah. It was interesting to see, and I was commenting on this as we were going into watching the movie, and I kind of had this expectation that I would be dealing with something a little bit new here, to have Benson and Moorhead dealing with more name actors, because up to this point, they've been fairly low-budget affairs. Their first movie, again, Resolution, didn't have actors I recognized from anything else in the two leads. I forget who the male lead in Spring is. I think I've seen him in other stuff, but not, like, a ton of other stuff. And then The Endless, Benson and Moorhead are actually playing, like, versions of themselves.
Right.
Which makes it even more fourth wall, breaky, wibbly-wobbly.
Yeah. Well, now they're joining the MCU. Speaking of cinematic universes, moving up in the world.
Doing Moon Knight, the Moon Knight show. But yeah, so obviously they're not big name guys really outside of the horror or, you know, horror/sci-fi community, and particularly not as actors themselves. And now you have Anthony Mackie, who's pretty well known, has been for 10 or 15 years, and Jamie Dornan maybe a little bit less so, but he was in all those fucking 50 Shades movies, so people know him. And it was just kind of interesting to see how they transitioned into a movie that's got more star power behind it. I don't want to imply necessarily that the performances prior to this with the lesser known actors have been like less charismatic or anything, because that's not true, but it is a little bit different to see, like, oh, it's fucking Anthony Mackie in a Benson and Moorhead movie. That's cool.
Yeah. I think, and this probably comes down to personal taste to an extent. Like I said, I'm more of a horror junkie than a sci-fi guy, but the actual depiction of, I said that, you know, his skin starts Swiss cheesing when he's going to and fro. And the first time you see that, it's a little disconcerting, but it quickly starts, this is not meant to be a pun, it's a kind of cheesy effect after a certain point. It's very like, you can imagine him waking up at spear, you know, the end of a proto-human spear, and asking the question to his hypothetical fellow traveler, the question isn't where are we, but when are we? You know, that kind of time travel movie. It's very tropey, but I don't dislike that. It's maybe just not for me. At least it's not for me to the same extent that the charred corpse in the middle of the abandoned carnival is for me.
that is just my bread and butter. if I was to look up Matt Jarendaisy in the dictionary,
yep,
I would see a picture of a charred corpse at an abandoned carnival.
What can I say?
Yeah, I'm with you there. Obviously, we're doing a horror movie podcast, so we go into these movies looking for a horror experience, and we're film dorks more generally, so it's not as though our tastes are especially narrow. We watch and enjoy sci-fi movies too, but yeah, I think, as I said earlier on in this segment, I probably agree with you that a little bit more horror flavor to this movie probably would have been more to my liking, but I still enjoyed the end product for what it was.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to enjoy sci-fi movies more when they do have overt horror elements, you know, like either version of The Fly, for example. It's that story is just automatically more interesting to me if it features a prominent body horror abomination, or if the man-fly hybrid finds his way into a spider's web for the climax. You know, that if it's scary, if it roots you to your seat in a kind of visceral way, I like that more than science fiction that kind of like, oh, it makes you think or makes you consider your place in the cosmos. You know, that kind of, I don't know that sci-fi geeks go apeshit for that stuff in the same way that I go apeshit for bodies at the bottom of elevator shafts or women with,
or a cockroach death sequence.
Yeah, or women with inexplicable snake bites. But for what it's worth, and if you're listening to this podcast, well, you likely know me personally, A. And B, you hopefully like horror movies and maybe share my predilections. So, I don't know. It's just the movie lost me after a certain point. But there's stuff that emerges towards the end of the movie. There's a beat. We didn't touch on this at all. We learn about tragic event in Anthony Mackie's background where his buddy were doing cleanup after Hurricane Katrina. And we've gotten glimpses of three caskets in what looks to be a flooded street. We get some of it when Anthony Mackie is in the MRI, or other moments where he's just under duress. We just get brief snatches of that imagery. And then Jamie Dornan, in a flashback, I believe, is telling his wife what that's all about. They were doing cleanup after Hurricane Katrina, and some coffins had been washed out of a local cemetery, and three of the coffins contained his parents, I think, and
his
parents
and his little sister,
younger sister, who died young. And that's an upsetting incident, and it could have been a real knockout horror set piece. It could have been trashy, you know, if it had been done in a kind of tasteless or exploitative way, but that's just on paper, that's a really eerie sequence. But it's not done that way, and by the time that anecdote is deployed in the movie, it's kind of too late for it to have any horror heft to it. It's merely sad. Yes. At that point, because we've moved into full-blown sci-fi drama mode. And I don't know if I'd call that a missed opportunity per se. It's more just a symptom of this movie having two bears inside of it. You know, if we'd gotten that story in the first act, there would have been a scare cord accompanying it, and one of the lids would have fallen off, and you would have actually seen what they looked like.
Right.
But instead, it's just a sad story. And to me, that constitutes something of a missed opportunity. If you don't roll the way that I roll, then you might feel totally differently about it.
Yeah, your mileage may vary.
Right.
I touched briefly in the synopsis on some cuts that the movie does. Matt raised the issue first specifically with the scene where Anthony Mackie takes the drug for the first time, and there's a jump cut just kind of sitting on his couch like, this drug ain't shit.
Yeah.
earlier on in the movie, it happens where, like, he'll be at a bar getting shit-faced or something, and then he'll, like, stop moving for a second, and then it's the kind of cut where it cuts to him in an entirely different place, but he's in exactly the same framing and physical position relative to the frame.
Uh-huh.
So it looks like he's teleported, which is topical.
Yeah, it's fitting.
And apt. And he does this. This happens to him like three or four times prior to him actually getting a hold of this drug and start to conduct experiments and so forth. So it sets up this thing where he's already kind of unstuck and skipping through his existence between the drinking and the drug use. And
yes,
also,
through the magic of editing, you know, like Godardian jump cuts.
And just having a lot on his mind too with the cancer diagnosis. So I thought that was a good stylistic touch for sure.
Yeah, no, that was rather good. It was not lost on me either. My favorite scene, I think, is one that we also elided. Nothing much emerges from it of any import. It's just the two paramedics getting into an argument when they're on the job. They are not arresting, surely. I don't think that's out of their jurisdiction, but they're apprehending a guy who's dressed up like Baron Samedi, and he's like
right.
Cackling as they're really laying into each other. They've got him on a stretcher. He's tripping on something, and
I think his leg's like really fucked up, like he might have a compound fracture, you know, like bones sticking out and
yeah
stuff.
But he's just having a grand old time. So the entire time that they're yelling at each other about, no, you're more of a fuck up, they've got this witch doctor between them just like yucking it up. And it's funny because it's another example of a moment that could have been played as horror instead being played. I mean, in that case, it's more just straight comedy, I think. But
yeah.
And there's a fair bit of that in this movie. But after a certain point, you can't write them off as missed opportunities. It's just misaligned priorities.
I mean, the
filmmaker's priorities are not my priorities.
Right. Yeah, just a series of deliberate decisions to not make this a horror beat.
Yeah, and it did work as a comedy moment for me, so I'm not even knocking it. I said it might be my favorite moment in the movie.
It is pretty funny. Yeah, I mean, I guess just to sum up, Anthony Mackie and Jamie Dornan are both good. Even though they interact with plenty of other characters, it is for the most part a two-hander. And I mean, for certain stretches, it's even just a one-hander. You know, Anthony Mackie by himself,
yeah,
skipping through time. But they're both good. They're both very entertaining. They have good chemistry and play off each other well. And also watching Anthony Mackie doing his time travel home videos is a lot of fun. So it's good stuff. And Justin Benson can write a snappy script, and the Benson and Moorhead can direct well. I mean, the example that we've already laid out with the scene transitions and those jump cuts, that kind of illustrates they know a little bit of what they're doing.
Yeah, this is, I would say, probably their most stylish movie. The scene of them going into the flop house, finding the guy who's been run through with the cutlass, and the lady in the next room ODing, is all done in one shot.
Yeah.
The camera is sort of migrating back and forth from one room to the other, from one paramedic to the other, because they kind of break off and tend to each of the poor schmucks separately. And
yeah,
then the cops show up with their guns drawn initially because there was some snafu. They weren't expecting paramedics.
Well, and Anthony Mackie isn't wearing his uniform. He's wearing something else that may or may not be the work attire of the woman he slept with.
Uh-huh.
So it's working at like a sports store or something.
Yeah, and crucially, the boorish asshole cop thinks that he's just another junkie initially. Or, you know, doesn't know who he is, but doesn't think he's law enforcement.
Makes a crack about him, quote, being dressed like Tupac.
And we might be wrong about pineal gland, but we are faithfully preserving the mispronunciation of Tupac.
So
and that's a neat touch, just because it confirms. I mean, so much of this movie reminded me of, I think, the Louis C.K. routine about how a non-white person with a time travel machine has limited options.
Yeah, could go back like maybe 20 to 30 years and only to certain places.
And Anthony Mackie runs afoul of racists almost everywhere he goes once he starts time traveling. But in the present, he also almost is shot by a colleague for being black in the wrong place at the wrong time in improper attire.
Right.
You know, so being in the present is not that much of a safeguard against
no panacea.
That sort of thing. So that was a well observed and a good shot. All, you know, the point being that's a long take and a lot of things happen in it and there's layers. So if the Baron Samedi thing isn't my favorite scene, I would say that shot is probably the other standout moment for me.
Yeah, me too. As far as recommendations go, obviously we've already talked at length just about the entire Benson Moorhead oeuvre. We're fans of almost all of their work as a general rule. The one big glaring awful fucking exception,
oh fuck yeah, I forgot about this,
is they did a segment for VHS Viral. Now Matt and I like VHS and VHS 2.
I don't think VHS 2 has a bad segment in it. I think VHS is half good,
right?
VHS Viral is all bad.
So that most trilogy of runs the whole gamut. Right. Like, VHS Viral is, no hyperbole, one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
And I've seen people saying that Moorhead and Benson's segment in VHS Viral is, like, the good one.
It's not.
I didn't like it at
all. No, it's not. There's another one that has, like, one sort of, it's got a charming performance in it, even though overall it's still not great.
Yeah, I mean, the one about the evil magician is fun in like an R.L. Stine kind of way.
Right.
But still cheap and disposable.
Yeah, still not great. And then the Benson and Moorhead segment is just bad.
It's about these insufferable skater kids who run afoul of demons.
Yeah, basically.
And no, it's shot in GoPro mode. I mean, it's a found footage format, I understand, but it's like a lot of fisheye lenses from what I remember, really kind of just stomach churning footage.
That movie's just awful.
Hard to watch, hard to listen to, just hard to experience. It's ugly movie.
Yeah, but with the exception of their contribution to VHS Viral, all the stuff of theirs we've seen is good. We've seen all their features to this point, so go out and check out their stuff. In terms of more specific recommendations beyond what we've already kind of discussed at length, Matt, how about you go first?
I'm tempted to just recommend Nightmare on Elm Street 4 or 5 or whatever it was, just because you said the words cockroach death sequence to me, and now that's all 4. I can think about. I think it is 4. I'm hard-pressed to think of a horror time travel movie that I liked. This is a little bit of a, I don't know, a shitlord kind of a comment. I guess, well, it's I don't know if it's a hot take per se. I don't want to quibble about these things. I used to maintain that The Terminator was my favorite slasher movie. And I think it does adhere to the formula enough. Obviously, it's anomalous in that it's also a sci-fi action movie.
Right.
But the T-800 really does operate like a slasher villain, you know, like plotting like Jason Voorhees and just going from victim to victim, from one Sarah Connor to the next, just offing people. But that's a fairly tenuous connection, I think. Not that that's stopped us before. I'm just trying to think if I can generate anything better. This is even more tenuous, and I don't think I've recommended it, at least not formally. I might have alluded to it here or there. There's a movie called Cure. It's by Kiyoshi Kurosawa, director of Pulse, and it's really excellent. It's grown on me. It's about a string of random killings and an inspector tasked with finding out what all of these random schmoes who went ballistic have in common, and they have all had encounters with the same drifter, who is a mesmerist who's drifting around hypnotically inducing people to do ghastly crimes. All of the murders feature the same calling card, the same marks carved into the victim's torso, and it's just a hypnotic movie by design. It's about hypnosis, mesmerism. And I've rewatched it once or twice. The first viewing, I didn't know what to make of it. Since then, I've seen it a handful of times, and it really kind of sucks you in. It has virtually nothing in common with today's film. However, if Benson and Moorhead and Benson, if they had tried to stick to the police procedural format for the duration and still made it about this brain scrambling, time hopping sci-fi drug, that is one way that they could have gone about it, because keeping the perspective in Cure relatively grounded and just showing you matter of factly these supernatural happenings keeps a kind of, I mean, I do think that straight up paranormal stuff happens in that movie, but there's plausible deniability basically all the way through. And it creates this really eerie feeling. We've complained before about movies that try to have it both ways or that are too wishy-washy. Cure exists in a nether space where it's just like the exact right amount of uncertainty.
Ambiguous.
Yeah, right. It's a very fine art, a very delicate balancing act. And I don't blame any filmmaker for not wanting to walk that tightrope. I think that movies about time travel, they don't necessarily have to come down definitively on one side or the other. Obviously, if you're going to actually depict someone going into the past and returning with like a doubloon or a pirate sword, then the movie has decided which side of the bed to wake up on, as it were. But I think I would have preferred to drag out that police procedural horror thread for as long as possible before shifting gears into sci-fi mode. And I think Cure is a really classy, effective movie that would have given them kind of a blueprint for how to go about that. Because I do, and it took me a few viewings to arrive at this conclusion, I do think that, as I said, supernatural shit goes down in that movie. But even on successive viewings, that's really not apparent for the bulk of the runtime. And I think that maybe if it had just taken longer for Anthony Mackie to get his hands on the junk, then this movie would have been way more in my wheelhouse, I think. And it's just a question of, 20 minutes? 20 to 40 minutes? Well, less than 40. An act here, an act there. I don't know. I think that Terminator is my recommendation on just genre grounds. And then Cure is my cure-all, I guess. I mean, that's the movie that I would point to and say, I wish they had done more to try to emulate this. But I like Cure a lot. Not every movie can be Cure. And there is something to be gained for going whole hog into unapologetic, undisguised science fiction. I think a lot of the Billy Pilgriming is good fun. Cavemen and conquistadors and all that. I don't dislike the movie that we wound up with, believe it or not.
So I have two recommendations also. So this is the recommendations segment is just miles long, including the prior Benson and Moorhead films, but they're both movies that I would say are science fiction first, but they do the horror thing much more than Synchronic ended up doing it, which I think puts both of these movies more in our wheelhouse, and theoretically, as listeners to a horror movie podcast, more in your wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
The first is Annihilation, which came out nearly 3 years ago now. It was February of 2018, I believe.
It's all just grooves on a record, man.
Now that we live in the nowhere times.
Yes, the interminable, everlasting present, the year that will not end.
So it's an Alex Garland film, Ex Machina, and also he wrote Sunshine. He's worked with Danny Boyle on a variety of films. I think 28 Days Later also. And it's about this zone where basically on the inside of it, there's like biological destabilization going on. A lot of sort of atmospheric crossbreeding, if you will.
Yeah, hybridization of flora and fauna.
Yeah.
Plants becoming animals, animals becoming plants, and
animals becoming part of other animals,
right,
etc. And I was reminded of Annihilation
almost immediately, right? Like opening scene?
Yeah.
That's when it was on my mind, and then I swiftly forgot about it. So good on you for picking that out.
Because when the two people in the hotel are tripping balls and, like vines and plants are sort of phasing into that hotel room.
Yeah.
It very much had an Annihilation vibe. And Annihilation is terrific.
Yes.
Really, really like Annihilation. I mean, I'm a big Alex Garland fan. I'm an Ex Machina stan for sure.
Yeah, I liked Ex Machina too, but Annihilation is outstanding. I agree.
So yeah, I mean, that has a lot going for it. Great performances, very spooky, very unsettling, and also very sci-fi. I hear the novel and novel series by extension that it's based on is also very good, but I can't speak to that myself because I haven't read them yet. I think I'll try that at some point. The other film that I would like to recommend is Event Horizon.
Okay.
It follows a group of deep space explorers who approach a black hole, basically. I don't remember a lot of the really fine plot details, but
I think they board a derelict vessel that has been through a black hole, I think. And been to, like, a space outside of space. Been to hell, I think, is the implication. Been to literal hell.
Yeah. So you're picking up on the fact that it's sci-fi horror.
Right. Well, both of those movies are a good example of movies in which the horror and science fiction are wedded inseparably, where you can't have one without the other.
Yeah, and Sam Neill's in the lead. He's the captain, and watching him kind of slowly lose his mind is a rather delicious sight. Lawrence Fishburne's also in it, and he's a lot of fun.
Jason Isaacs,
I think
my favorite performance.
Stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's just movie's a lot of fun, and again, it's a sci-fi movie that is also horror. It's a lot of those horror beats, again, by choice as opposed to the obvious choice that Benson and Moorhead appear to have made for Synchronic to steer more into the straight sci-fi, which, you know, again, that was up to them. That wasn't necessarily what we expected. But if you're looking for more sci-fi horror, Annihilation and Event Horizon are both good options in that realm.
They're both sort of Tarkovsky riffs. Annihilation is definitely, I would think, like a pseudo remake of Stalker, although it brings a lot of new stuff to the table. And then Event Horizon is very much like a pulp Solaris.
Yeah,
so yeah, I'm a slut for Tarkovsky, so I like both of those movies a good deal.
Well, on the note of Matt being a slut for Tarkovsky, I yes. think we'll
it's gonna be my official
episode.
Sign-off phrase from now on. I've been looking for a fucking catchphrase.
I'm Matt Gerundaisy, and I'm a slut for Tarkovsky.
He's Jim Smith. I'm Matt Gerundaisy. We're the slut doctors. Yuck.
Yeah, no thanks.
Pop a fucking Synchronic pill just so I can go back in time and throttle myself before I say that.
Give yourself a soft reboot. We'll see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Synchronic Trailer Number 1, 2020, Movie Clips Trailers, uploaded by Movie Clips Trailers. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, February 21st, and we'll be discussing the Freaky Friday slasher movie riff, Freaky. See you then.